We're going to be taking a look at control and predictability. What happens when the unthinkable happens? Whether it's a large-scale natural disaster, of course, the sheer unfolding devastation in Japan is extraordinary. I've had so many conversations with people. They turned the television on and they thought that they were watching Armageddon or 2012. It's just extraordinary. The devastation is exactly that. It is absolutely devastating. And of course, whether you're looking back toward the MENA region with all of the unrest across here, horrifying images coming out of Libya, whether you're seeing all the Saudi tanks moving into Bahrain over the last couple of days, it's just a very, very strange world we're living in right now. So it does prompt the question, what happens when we feel that we lose control and life becomes unpredictable? Because I think inherently most people like to have a little bit of control and a little bit of predictability in their lives.
You're using two words that are very important, self-control and predictability. Mm. Many times people will hold on to a bad thing because it's predictable rather than trying to something new. In psychology, this may be seen as that resistance to change. Now, we're not talking about voluntary change that people can resist. We're talking about situations where a person is forced into change. It can be quite frightening because people don't know what's going to happen next. They don't know if they're going to step on a time bomb. They don't know if they're going to step into mud. They don't know if they're going to step onto gold.
Or whether they're going to be affected by radiation.
And exactly, and you don't know the difference between man-made and naturally made disaster. Mm-hmm. People, believe it or not, can accept natural disaster, even if it's frightening, because they know that they had nothing to do with it, nor did anybody else. But when it's man-made, there's a lot of anger and hurt that goes along with this. There's the devastation that maybe they should have fought, and that there's the survivor guilt of people who are not there going through the same pain as their relatives. So all kinds of problems go on psychologically that also will affect us physically. Many times people who experience devastation will go through shock, and sometimes this shock is handled different ways. Some people will immediately become devastated and they can't do anything. They have to have someone guide them to get them into safety during their shock. Others have delayed reaction and they're able to take command of the situation. They're able to get to safety. Once everything is fine, that's when they have their breakdown. Fortunately, there's two kinds of people in the world, and one can help the other to safety. And then once safety is there, the other can help the one who got them to safety when they have their breakdown. So people function in different ways, and it's not a matter of right and wrong or good or bad. It's just a matter of the way people function differently. So when we look at devastation, we're looking at the shock, sometimes denial. We go through the anger about its existence, how things are unfair and inconsistent. Then we start to realize we've got to take charge. We have to do something. We don't have time to take this stress situation and do nothing. That stress situation can become the motivator for a lot of people because people do want to survive, and people will do anything that they have to do to survive. Very few people will go into learned helplessness right away. Learned helplessness is usually a process over a period of time where you realize that no matter what you do, it's not going to work. So you kind of just lay down and just wait to die, which is very unhealthy. But then again, that can happen in any situation, even when there's domestic abuse. So whether the abuse is domestic or whether it's a natural disaster or man-made disaster, people will have a similar reaction of dealing with the disaster, recovery from that disaster, and how to cope with it in a productive fashion. For instance, you have people who, if they're attacked by other human beings, they then attack as well, and they go on the attack forever. There's also cultures who don't do that. Many people who are attacked or maybe taken over in a hostile takeover of a nation or something, they become very productive, and they realize that the way to best defeat their enemy is to be the opposite of what their enemy wanted. They wanted them to be at their beck and call, and they weren't. These people became productive. They began to produce their own system of operation. They became independent, which is sometimes the best way to
be. Egypt is the example that you're thinking of when you're saying that?
Actually, it was Tibet.
All right.
when they were taken over, they became very productive people. They did fight for a little while, but they actually became quite productive. There's other cultures who kind of just do nothing but fight back. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're talking about Egypt, what you're talking about are people who stood up to the government. And their standing up to the government was in a very honorable way, believe it or not. Now, many people might say, yeah, but we were watching television, there was a lot of harm. Frankly, there wasn't. You know, okay, it's too bad that one person could get hit, not just a hundred or a thousand could get killed. But the fact is, there wasn't the coup d'etat that was requiring the assassination of anyone. It was done in a matter of saying, we want our rights, this government is not providing those rights, so what we want is we want for this government to step down, put an interim government in, and then let us look at a new style of existence. Can we afford to be a democratic nation, or do we need to be a dictatorial nation, or do we need to be a nation that allows freedom no matter what you call the economic or the political process that's going to govern us?
It does raise a very interesting question as to what happened in Egypt. And then if you look at traditional political models and traditional political parties, some people would argue the failure of traditional political models and parties. So what will become of Egypt is the million dollar question. Who knows?
But you know, Egypt is not who initiated this. It actually was initiated in Tunisia.
Of course.
And Tunisia's uprising also gave a sense of alliance to other nations, including Egypt. Mm-hmm. So what you now saw was a chain reaction. Well, if this country can do it, then we can too. Let's make some drastic changes. Now, at one time, these particular leaders were seen as favorable, because they may have come in at a time that they were needed. But when staying too long and nothing changes and people aren't having that sense of productivity,
freedom as well,
they're not having that sense of belonging,
human dignity,
they're not sense of fairness, mm-hmm, that's when they say, we do need a change in the policy. Mm-hmm. We need a change. And if that policy means a change in the people who are making those policies, then so be it. But it actually did encourage change to take place. Now, I would venture to say that we shouldn't be looking at conspiracy theories here.
Absolutely.
We need to just be looking at people's rights to exist in fairness, equality, to feel that they are provided for, that they're protected, and that they're going to be bonded as one nation. See, a lot of people will talk about, yes, we are proud to be of this country, and we sit under this flag, and we salute this flag, and we will always do what this flag represents. That's great when you're outside of your country, but what happens when you repatriate, you go back into your country? You may fall into that same trap of discord, unfairness, and prejudice that you grew up in and realize something different when you left, but the people who never left that country of origin are still
in
suffering
that space.
It.
Mm-hmm.
So what we see in becoming an expat, it's much easier than repatriating to your own country, mm-hmm, politically as well as economically.
Mm-hmm. Ekwan on Twitter, very good morning to you, Ekwan, is saying, man-made devastation can break hearts and cause permanent psychological impacts. Natural calamities are adaptable most of the time. I think that's very well put. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for that. What's going on in Japan is the unfolding devastation. It's just extraordinary. Every day to wake up, to turn on the television, to see imagery from Libya to Bahrain, whether it be Yemen, and then, of course, across to Japan. It's just an extraordinary time that we seem to be living in right now. I'm referring to the BBC right now. They're running a report. They're talking about the current situation in Japan, talking about the rise in radiation levels at Japan's stricken Fukushima nuclear plant, forcing workers to suspend their operations. And, of course, that has officially come from the Japanese government. 9.0 magnitude is what they've confirmed of last Friday's earthquake and tsunami, which, of course, has killed thousands. Many people still yet to be found. And now the site itself, the one that is in great concern at the moment, it's been hit by several explosions triggering radiation leaks, and France has urged its nationals living in Tokyo to leave the country or head to southern Japan because of the risk of radiation. Of course, we know the Philippine government, they've also done the same as well in other countries, getting their people out. out. They want to get them away from harm's way, whether it be Japan, whether it be countries around here. It's extraordinary times that we're living in. So many measures are being taken to move people away from that danger. But it does still raise the question of control and predictability. Would you say that the world is in a state of lost control and unpredictability? Many people would probably agree with that right now.
There's one of the social network systems that's opened up its doors and programs for people who may be displaced and needing to find loved ones. And it's quite remarkable that immediately this particular social network community opened up its web, its internet system, so that people can try to find each other when they're able to find an internet system and go online. One of the greatest fears in this situation is when you have loved ones who you're not with and you don't know where they are, and if they're children, are they going to be taken care of? Are they going to be neglected? Are they going to suffer in the dying process? It's one thing to know that you're going to die, but it's another thing to know that you're going to die with pain. Here we have a situation where your loved ones, you don't know where they are. They may be little children who have been separated from parents or grandparents, and you don't know if that child is being taken care of by another adult to help them through whatever suffering they may go through. So there's a lot of psychological despair in this unknown scenario of where are my loved ones? What's going to happen to me and my loved ones? Will we ever see each other again?
Each embassy have their own contact details, emergency contact numbers. The Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade is where Australians can go to get information on their loved ones and friends in Japan. Of course, each country has their own numbers, as I said. If you would like me to look up your country, all you need to do is SMS 4001, and I'll do that this morning. You can also go to Google's Person Finder, 2011 Japan earthquake. They're currently tracking around 214,000 records.